Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates. Good afternoon or good morning. Sorry, it's very presumptuous of me to think you're listening in the afternoon just because it's afternoon now. I am hiding in my bedroom. It's Sunday afternoon. We're about to eat a big roast dinner. I'm lying here with Ray, who's staying impressively quiet. We're about to have roast pork today. And I have been wearing a Christmas hat most of today because we've just finished decorating the tree. And actually, it did actually really work. I wasn't feeling Christmassy at all sort of this time yesterday. But now that there's tinsel and baubles and all that sort of stuff everywhere, my brain has gone, well, ho, 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 hold on, it's flipping Christmas. And if you're into that kind of thing, we're going to do a kitchen disco on the 18th of December at 6:30. So please, please do give me any Christmas song suggestions. There's loads of songs out there. There's a couple I'm like, definitely want to do that. But actually, I'm open to anything. Because it's sort of the same thing that happened when we did the Halloween one. I suddenly had like a complete brain freeze of trying to remember anything other than about 3 songs. Anyway, this week's guest is Sally Hughes. Oh, bless you, Ray. this week's guest is Sally Hughes. Beauty writer, editor, author. But actually, this particular conversation really, really resonated with me. Sally spoke with such intelligence and sensitivity about what it's like to be on the other side of divorce and raising kids in amongst an extended family. Her boys are now, I think she said they're 12 and 14. She might well correct me at the beginning of our chat. And they have been raised, she said, by her and her husband, Dan, but also by her ex-partner, who is their dad, and his new partner too. So that's very familiar to my story, really. I've always felt like I have 4 parents because my mum and dad split up when I was 4. So I know how that goes, but it sounds like they've done a really good job and she's really smitten with her teenage sons. That really, really comes across that she's raising 2 lovely boys that she's very proud of. So that gives us all hope, doesn't it, when we're in the midst of raising small people. What else did I want to say to you? Oh, yeah. So Sally and I, we haven't met many times, but a couple of times. But when she came to talk to me, we immediately started talking about the judgments that people make on parents who have children of all one gender. Obviously, as the mother of 5 sons, that is a topic very close to my heart. So the conversation we had kind of jumped sort of straight into that. So apologies if it's a bit more of a kind of 0-60 than my usual style, but we just got started and then I thought, hey, I better be recording this. Anyway, I will see you on the other side and thanks very much for giving me your ears once more. And lovely to see you. You know what time it is. It's cup of tea. There's always a cup of tea time, even if it's just before my roast dinner. In fact, I probably have one alongside me. And if I haven't told you before, it's white and two. And no, white and one sugar. Oh my goodness. I used to be white and two. I've grown out of it, I promise. Okie dokie, I sometimes have one and a half. But it's still, yeah, white with some sugar. Thanks very much. Hot and sweet. See you on the other side. I think the comments about the boy-girl thing is really strange. And I feel like the thing that always used to make me quite sensitive to it as a mother of sons, with this sort of inferred thing that I haven't experienced all aspects of motherhood because I haven't had a girl.
Oh, yes, because it assumes that your five boys are all exactly the same.
Exactly.
That if you have boys, they're one thing. Yeah. And if you have girls, they're another thing. But that's so absurd, because my kids are obviously completely different people. And I have more in common with one of my brothers than he has with one of my other brothers. Do you know what I mean? You know, we're just kind of people and we have some things in common, some things not.
Well, the thing is, when people have comments to say about their expectations of your children, it always says more about them than you
and
anyway.
And their parenting, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Because then I'd say, well, if I was, let's say I wanted a girl, I'd then have an expectation of what that meant and
yes,
who
absolutely.
She already is.
Absolutely.
Ditto if I say I want a boy, I've got an expectation of who he is. And I don't actually have that. I've never had that with any of the babies.
Me neither.
Along and I meet them when they happen to be a baby and then they let me know what they need from me.
There's that thing that people do a lot where they kind of put a personality on an unborn child where they go, oh, you can tell she's going to be such a diva. She's always kicking. It's like, no, don't do that.
I know.
Because she might be a really kind of nerdy, bookish, quiet child, or she might be kind of strident and opinionated, but kind and, you know, all of these things we impose on something that doesn't really exist other than as a part of your body.
I know, but I do wonder as well, sorry, we sort of jumped straight into a chat, but I do find this kind of thing fascinating because I think that the more, this is my own theory, but I don't know, so the more we've got better at discussing what gender means for adults, and the more we're trying to socially accept the spectrum of gender, the more binary I think it's got in what we impose on children. So the whole, like, boys play with blue things, girls play with pink things. You know, girls get, you get horses, girls, and you get cats. Yeah. Boys, you've got dogs and dinosaurs. Hope you're okay with that.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of very split.
You'll know from having boys that people assume that they're really boisterous and mad and crazy. And so they say, oh, bet it's a handful around your house, as though a girl will be really meek and quiet and docile and the boys will just be hellraisers.
It's true. But then every once in a while when the kids are all kicking off and I'm like, this is what people think I go home to. Can you please stop it? I think, yeah, it's. I can see as well, it's quite a nice feeling now, but when I tell people, if I say, oh, I've got five kids, and they kind of give me a, oh, like they have to like reassess. But then when I say it's five boys, I often get this like moment where they kind of have to reassess me, like, oh, I didn't realise you're the mother of five sons. Like,
Yeah.
Now I'm trying to figure that out as well. I quite like that.
Like you're some mafia mama.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's kind of cool though. I'd go with that. I think that's quite funny.
Well, I quite like that. And it's quite funny as well having all these, the moment, small children who one day will all be taller than me.
Yeah,
that's quite a funny idea.
Yeah, and you're quite tall, but they will be.
I sort of practice with a little one holding above me like, can I go out?
My eldest son is taller than me.
Oh, so how old is he? How old is
he? He's 15.
15, okay.
And Arthur is 13.
So you've got Marvin who's 15 and Arthur's 13.
Yeah.
So you've got two teenagers. You made it through to that bit.
Yes, best bit.
Yeah, I actually really love having a teenager. I hang out with Sunny a lot and we have a very balanced, calm relationship, actually.
Yeah, so do we. It's nice.
In fact, from my birthday this year, he gave me a card that said, lots of love from your counsellor, because I think he feels that's basically what I do. I kind of come in and I just like offload everything that's been annoying me, bothering me.
It's lovely when they get to that then, and you can have proper conversations.
Definitely. And so we are talking today, just fresh off your radio show going out last night.
Oh, yeah.
All about trolling and dragging sites, which I found absolutely fascinating, and there were so many parts of it that really made me think. I think the two things that really stuck out for me, one was when a lady who'd been really badly trolled, she'd had her father die, and so her and her sister had set about raising
raising
a lot of money and had all this horrible stuff online. She said something like, you expect it wasn't your run-of-the-mill trolling, as if
she said Her, as you rightly say, her father had died. They were raising money. She'd had an utterly hideous time where people were accusing her of buying into a conspiracy of coronavirus, that coronavirus didn't exist, and how she had killed her father to be part of this conspiracy. And as she was explaining it to me, as you say, she said, well, it started off just, you know, your kind of bog standard trolling, yeah. as though a certain degree of trolling would be expected when your father just dies of coronavirus.
Yeah, or even to anyone who's in, and who all puts themselves into like a public platform.
Yeah, and she's just a normal girl. She's a trainee solicitor in Wigan, and the only reason she was put in the public eye is she was trying to raise money for a charity.
Yeah, that's horrific. So that really struck me, because I thought, actually, I think people do anticipate that some of this nastiness is going to come your way no matter who you are or what it is you're doing, and actually that's fundamentally wrong. And the second thing was when you were saying about the thing that's really terrifying is, because of the anonymity, you get this fear because you don't know who it is or where it's coming from, and the fact that it can change the way you shape your life and how vulnerable you feel, even when you're someone that's supported and loved and has a solid home life, solid family. And you said even for you, you found that it was affecting your behaviour, and I think you went on a work trip and took your husband when you wouldn't normally.
I had to go to Paris to write something, an English thing for a company over there, and it had been booked for ages. I was committed to it. I had to go, but this had all just happened about a year ago. And the night before, I was just sitting in bed going, I can't do it, I can't go, I can't go. And so my husband said, what about if I come? And so I was on the Eurostar website really late the night before. I spent such a huge amount of money on a ticket because it was last minute, but I just literally couldn't get on the train without him. I was so scared. And I think anybody who knows me knows that that is so off-brand for me. I'm a bold person, you know. I'm not a fearful person by nature. I'm generally an optimistic type. And that was really uncharted territory for me. And things like, you know, during COVID, when we're wearing face masks, I was talking to my husband the other day and I was saying that actually I have been more relaxed in public since COVID than I was in the year before it, because people can't see my face. And prior to that, I just kept thinking people were watching me, that people were going to stop me. And in fact, they did. Several people stopped me. Nice people, kind people stopped me in the aftermath of the trolling incident to say how sorry they were. And they were really sympathetic. But of course, you think, well, if they recognise me and they're saying, sorry, who else is seeing me and what are they saying? And so actually having a face mask has made me relax a lot more than I had.
Yeah, I actually think I can totally see that. I found when my stepdad died a couple of months ago, being able to go out and about with a mask, I found really helpful, because it meant that I felt like I just could keep myself a bit tidied away, actually.
I know exactly what you mean. It's a sort of, it's a privacy, isn't it, that you're afforded. Anyway, there might as well be one positive to this whole horrible situation. That's kind of the only one I can think of. But it has definitely, just that aspect of it has allowed me to feel a bit more guarded, a bit more private, a bit less exposed.
Yeah, I mean, I think we are allowed to look at what the positive aspects are about how the world has changed without any of a making the assumption that that means you actually wish it all just happened anyway.
Yeah, of course.
It's not clear.
Of course, pandemics, you do anything to take it away.
Thumbs down to pandemics, you know?
Yeah, down with this sort of thing, for sure. There are very, very few redeeming features, but that's one aspect that at that particular time in my life, I have come to realise I needed to just be a bit hidden away.
And how aware are your boys of what had been going on? And
well, they're teenagers, so they're totally aware.
They're totally aware. Hard for them.
Yeah, and hard for me as well, because it's kind of shaming, isn't it? So my youngest son, his school teacher approached me at a school event to say she'd read it all and how sorry she was, and I just wanted to die. I wanted the ground to swallow me up. And then my eldest son is 15. So, of course, all his friends have heard, because that's how teenagers work. They all talk to each other on Snapchat. And that's incredibly humiliating. I mean, they've been great, obviously, and their parents have been great. But you just feel as though you're kind of walking through a market town with no clothes on, basically.
Oh, yeah, I suppose. It's so important to get it out there, but it is a thing that, yeah, you have to say, this made me feel really vulnerable and really sad. But then it probably opens up the chat for so many people who've been affected in lots of ways by by gossip and things that have been put online. And it's actually really important that people do stop and think before they put anything out there. I mean, sometimes I'll even read, like, friends of mine put things and I just think, what if that gets back to them, you know? Like, it's quite...
Yeah.
You have to be so careful.
Yeah, probably the same thing has happened to you. I've been asked many a time to go on a TV programme to kind of slag someone off, or, you know, slag someone off the telly, or, you know, oh, what does she look like? What's he doing? Whatever. And for years now, I just say no, because I think, well, how would I feel if somebody was talking about me like that, or one of my friends, or one of my kids? And so I don't get involved in that stuff at all anymore.
Yeah. I mean, maybe, I don't think your boys sound like they would ever have done anything like that anyway, but it probably makes them very switched on with that, sort of very sensitive to that, just generally and across their social group as well, because kids can be pretty unkind sometimes, especially at that age, just like in their social group. So
yeah, although I know what you're saying, but the other thing that's been really interesting and life-affirming actually about the whole thing is that so my house has always got teenagers in it. So pre-COVID, there were just kids everywhere, eating too much food and leaving massive shoes in the hallway and all of that stuff. And I have never seen any behaviours that their parents couldn't be really proud of.
Oh, that's lovely.
And the behaviour I've seen from adults online is just unimaginable and inconceivable to the kids I know. You know, the kids I know are much nicer than the adults I've seen.
Yeah, actually online. That's true. And I think that I feel like my eldest and your boy's generation is actually pretty... They've got quite a good moral compass about things.
I agree.
And I think we've put so much more emphasis now on kindness, being tolerant, being open-minded, having difficult discussions, way, way more than I was when I was a teenager,
totally.
I think. Yeah, it's quite funny actually to think back about some of the stuff that was really taboo and things that were sort of happening in the shadows. And now I think they're much more given a centre stage, you know, mental health issues, how you feel about your figure, how you feel about your friendships, you know, starting relationships, all these things have just come on so much more now. Still a long way to go, but
it's inspiring, I think, when you hear teenagers talk about some things. I find it really inspiring. I think, well, yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought of it like that, or you seem really switched on, and it's really nice to hear their views on things.
Yeah. So you were saying you're one of five, but you're the only girl, and so you've got four brothers.
Yeah.
So where are you in the lineup?
So I'm the baby of batch one. So batch one had three kids in it. So there were two boys, then me for a long time, and then there were two more boys.
So how old were you when the little ones were born?
So I think I was 10 or 11 when the next batch started.
Okay.
So when the second youngest boy was born, I was about 10.
So did you used to look after 11. The little ones a bit?
Completely. Because that's what happens, you'll know, that's what happens when you're in a big family. You're just constantly, like, holding a baby or cooking something for somebody. Everybody just has to muck in because it's too big.
Yes, definitely. That is actually one thing you just give yourself over to and go and ask someone else. And it's actually really nice when someone else does sort of step in. I think actually sometimes as a mum, you first want to be sort of all things to all people. And one of the benefits of having a bigger family is you realise it's literally not possible, so you do just kind of accept defeat with that.
It's not possible, and also I sort of think that however many children you have, your job as a parent is to keep your children alive, first and foremost, alive and safe, but secondly it's to prepare them for adulthood. And I always felt when I became an adult, I knew how to cook, I knew how to do laundry, I knew how to run a home, basically. I knew how to be an adult. And I think if you don't let other kids take over a bit, or you don't delegate, I think you kind of deny them the development that they need to kind of look after themselves when they leave home.
Yeah, that is, it's true, especially as I can sort of see it on the horizon now with my eldest, and I think, okay, I've got my mum saying to me when I left home, I suddenly realised I didn't teach you how to make a white sauce, as if this was something like I absolutely had to know how to do. I still don't really think I've ever used... She did quickly show me, like, in my mid-20s at some point, but it's never really come into my cooking repertoire.
The kind of embarrassment you would feel if your boys went into the outside world and couldn't cook a girl a dinner.
Yeah.
You know, put something on the table. I would find that mortifying.
Yeah, I want them to be able to cook and I want them to be able to dance. That's like the two things. I think if a boy that can dance and cook, that's pretty good, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, and you know what it means. Good dance, good everything else.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, yeah, rhythm and having fun are very important factors.
Yes, exactly. For adulthood, certainly.
And did you always want to be a mum? Did you always envisage yourself as a mum?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I was thinking about this on the way here because I always think of you as a really kind of instinctively maternal person. This is the vibe you give off. And I didn't have that. I never... For a really, really, really long time, I didn't think I wanted children at all.
Oh, wow.
And then one day, I so wanted children, partly because I had met the father of my children. I really loved him and knew he would be a good dad. And I think that really influences things, of course. Partly, I think your hormones do kick in quite often and say, it's time, go, go, go. And from the moment that happened, I just really, really, really wanted kids and got pregnant really quickly and... I was very fortunate in that way. I've never had any difficulty getting pregnant and had them quite quickly. I wanted a small gap between them as well because we were very much, as one of five, we were a gang, and me and my two older brothers were all close in age and we were a real gang. We were best friends. We were together all the time and I wanted that for my kids.
Oh, so, do you, so it sounds very, very planned and into a very sort of stable home life. And is that something, were you working alongside that at the time, and did you have any worries about how it would work out?
So I would have done things so differently if I could go back. So when I had quite a difficult relationship with my mother, a very difficult relationship with my mother, and what that does, when you have children, you have very clear ideas on how you're going to do things. And very often they're the polar opposite to what your mother did. And so when I got pregnant with my eldest child, I said, right, I'm going to give up work and I'm going to be home all the time and I'm going to have the washable nappies and I'm going to puree the organic vegetables and mix them with breast milk and stuff.
Is this the opposite?
Well, it was just kind of chaotic and I had this very ordered idea that his childhood would be very ordered and structured and not chaotic and not kind of flying by the seat of your pants. And it would be very affectionate. And I just had all these rules for myself. And one of them was giving up work, which I did. And I went completely mad. You know, I had, I got postnatal depression partly because when my first baby was 11 weeks old, I think my father died. And so I became a parent and lost a parent for the first time in the space of 3 months and became really depressed. I also just... I was lonely. I was quite young, not young by the rest of the country standards, but young for London media standards. I was 29, I think, and 29, 30. And I was really lonely. I stopped getting invited to things. I just kind of fell off the planet, I felt. And I remember I was at a wedding with my ex-husband, a friend of his from university, and I had my 12-week-old baby on my knee. And we were in this country hotel and we were around this big round table of about 12 people. And there was a woman on the table and she said, she turned to the man on her left and she said, so what do you do? All these strangers getting to know each other. She said, what do you do? And he said, you know, I'm an estate agent or something. And she said, what do you do? Somebody said, I sell insurance or whatever it was. And she went round the table and I had the baby on my knee and she skipped past me and went to the person to my left. Oh. She just jumped over me because I had a baby. And I remember just feeling so... obviously furious, but so low about that. I just felt like I dropped off the side of the planet. I was really depressed and I feel really sad about that actually when I look back, because there are things that I should have done, i.e. give myself a break, that would have made me a lot happier. I was bereaved, I was lonely, I was depressed. And when I had my second child, just 2.5 years later, I was working again by then. I decided that I would carry on working as much as was comfortable for me. Obviously, I'm very lucky I work from home. And I decided I would carry on working as much as was comfortable and feasible, and that I would just not really care about what kind of mother I looked to the outside world. And it was just bliss. I loved him so much. The moment he... was put into my arms, I just adored him. He was so, it was just fun having him. And I didn't do any routine with him, and he slept in my bed and he treated me like a drinks dispenser in the bed. Like, we didn't do any of the stuff you're supposed to do. It was so freewheeling. And I kept on working and it was just bliss. And I experienced the thing that you're kind of meant to experience, which was the joy and the euphoria. Obviously, by then I was madly in love with my other son too. But those first few months, first time, were incredibly difficult. I think I overcompensate for that a little bit with my eldest because I feel so bad that I was so sad. We're really, really close, me and him.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, I'm really impressed that you managed to sort of give yourself this complete different experience the second time around, because that's not a very long gap of time. And you know, if you're dealing with things like depression and grief and feeling really isolated, they don't necessarily, you know, alleviate within 2 years. So you probably still had all those things in concurrent, but you also have found a way to sort of give yourself this other way to do it.
So what had happened was, when my father died, I inherited a tiny amount of money. And so I decided to take this money. I realised I was mad, and to take this money and spend literally all of it on therapy, which is what I did. So I went to therapy for the next 2 years. And the last therapy session I had in London, or maybe the penultimate one I had my second newborn with me, and she said, "You seem good." So that was it. Yeah.
That's actually quite an amazing...
Yeah, it was really lovely. I was sitting there feeding him, and at the end, she said, "I think you're good."
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's really moving. And I mean, I always think of babies like a sort of a happy thing that always brings happy stuff with it. And that's probably because of, for me, I was on my own till I was 8 after my parents separated. So this new baby, my brother, was like, "Oh, this is great. I'm not on my own and I've got this little person I can dedicate my life to." But actually, there's a lot of times when a new baby is actually brings about lots of other emotions you've never had before. And
yeah.
even,
yeah,
you know, for me, I was... in a new relationship with Richard, we were in love with each other, but I felt so isolated, actually.
Yes, it's really isolating.
Yeah, and I really didn't know who I really was or how to continue the life I had before as this new mum. So I really relate to that woman skipping you over at the event, the wedding. Was there weddings, you said?
Yeah, yeah.
Because you do just sort of feel like you're kind of, you just exist as that baby's mum.
You've ceased to exist because you had a baby. It's so weird. And
so
I thought,
weird.
you wait till you have a baby. You'll remember this, I hope, and think, ah.
Well, the thing is, I think people don't really tell you about that. And they sort of assume you're kind of probably all fine, thank you very much, if you're, especially if you have quite a traditional setup and you've got, you know, a roof over your head and a loving partner. And they think, well, you're probably fine. And I think sometimes you don't really check in on people brilliantly when they've got a newborn, because whoever has their first baby and thinks, yeah, I've got this, like, I don't think I've really met that person. I mean, obviously some of it comes a lot easier than other things, but I think I do remember feeling like, I felt like the experience of new motherhood as well, I felt kind of homogenized. Like if I went to a place where there was lots of other toddlers, I felt there was nothing to distinguish me as anything
different.
Yes,
I get that.
I'm just that person's chaperone and that's all I am. And, you know, that's your, you know, used little like snack bar wrapper. I'll put that in the bin and clear up here and look after your shoes there.
I mean, you're a carer, aren't
you?
And you can see why so many carers feel so excluded from society.
Yeah.
Because just the act of caring for somebody means that you are just a background artist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think there's so much pressure on mums when you're pregnant, like your plans, all these plans, I'm going to puree this and use it, proper nappies, and I'm going to do all this stuff, because you're ready to set it out in your head of, this is the kind of mother I want to be. And then, you know, your baby comes along and maybe that's not
You know, the penny really dropped for me when I realised that, you know, the best mother I could be was to be a happier mother.
Mm.
And that is the thing that has an impact, not the organic vegetables and the breast milk blended together in an ice cube tray, which is why when I had my second child, having done all of that with my first child, when I had my youngest son, he would like pick up Wotsits from a pub floor and I'd be like, oh, okay. Like, I just couldn't really, I didn't really have it in me to get worked up about it.
No.
And that's what happens when you have your second. That's why second children are often the chilled ones, because you're chilled.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, you start to realise, hang on a minute, I can't walk into a crowded room and say, that one, those people, they're the ones that were breastfed.
No,
they were
of course not.
And, you know, it's like,
of course not.
It all kind of irons out. There's, and, you know, just what, as you say, whatever makes you happy, whatever makes you feel like you're kind of enjoying it and have got the balance of caring for your baby and giving yourself a little bit of...
Yeah,
you know, respite from it too.
Yeah,
it's really hard though. I definitely don't feel like I figured that out with my first at all.
No, I know. I didn't know what I was doing. I was really competent with my first. I was really competent. Everything was clean. Everything was done at the right time. Mm. And I was on my game. But of course, I wasn't on my game. I was deranged, you know. Whereas second time, I just kind of let things fly and had a really lovely time.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So, and I was talking to a friend of mine recently. I said, who would you like me to speak to when I'm doing my podcast? And she said, is there anyone that you can think of that maybe doesn't have a mother that's a role model to them? Because so many people, when they're talking about parenthood, they reference their own mother as being there. And I thought, actually, there must be so many people who feel like that. And I sort of completely take it for granted that my mum is someone
I've
got
a nice mum, haven't you?
Yeah, but I lean on it really heavily. I sent her messages before you arrived. I phone her most days. But not everybody's lucky.
She's a very engaged grandparent as well, isn't she? She's a very involved and engaged grandmother.
She is, and in quite a smart way, which I hope I can do if I become a grandma, where she's actually definitely got her own life. And she's been so clever because she never takes more than one of my kids at once.
Nice. Yeah. That's probably nice for them, though, isn't it?
Lovely for them. They get this, you know, very sort of premier grandma experience. And her and my eldest are very, very close.
Nice.
And I'm glad he has that in his life, because I think sometimes that grandparent role, it might be someone, it could be, you know, one of your friends or someone, but another adult in their life that has this very non-judgmental exchange.
Yes. I think it's really lovely for kids to have a really close friend who's a different generation to them. I think it's really healthy.
So healthy. So in your experience, do you have those people in your son's life? Did you have them from the get-go? Were there people you spoke to?
I'm not at all religious. And yet I gave both of my children a full set of godparents because I wanted them to have close friends from an older generation who were not their parents, who they could go to if they didn't want to speak to their parents. And so they have a full squad of godparents who are all different types of people and all people that I trust completely. And so that was very important to me. And also because of my relationship with my family, it was important to me that they had the support structure that they might not necessarily have from their from my family, basically. And so I was very careful to kind of recruit them a squad. And I still really love the people I chose.
Did they have like two godmothers, two godfathers, four each?
Well, sort of. There's a two-man gay couple in there, so the numbers are slightly skewed. So there's two men in Australia who are some of my oldest friends, or one of them is one of my oldest friends. And then, they've both got some girls, and yeah.
No, I think godparents is like one of the hidden, like, brilliant things about bringing people that you feel are a family, but making it official, like part of your family.
Yeah, it's lovely.
A really special thing. And in fact, even now, sometimes I'd be like, oh, that would be a really good godmother. I think I've probably got to have another baby so that I can make them a godmother.
It matters though, doesn't it?
Oh,
it's
love
really
it.
Nice. I love it too. And my kids, one of my kids' godfather, the one who lives in Australia with his husband, he witnessed our wedding. And so we just involve him in everything because he's our family.
So this was, you didn't get married not that long ago. How long ago was
it? No,
so
I've been married twice. My existing permanent husband. So I don't know how to put it. You don't want to say current because it implies that it's a kind of
bit transient,
ephemeral thing. Yeah. So my husband now, we've been married for 3 years. together for much longer. And then my former husband, we were married for 10 years, together for 13.
Oh, wow, okay. And so how long were you a single mum in the middle?
About 18 months, something like that.
So Dan's been part of your son's lives for a long time.
Yes, yes. Yeah. He's known them since they were little, which is really, really lovely.
And so my maths is a bit... So how old were they then when they met him?
I think they were something like 7 and 5
oh, yes.
or something. Mm. So they were little. Mm. And he's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. It's been a learning experience for him, for sure.
Did he have kids in his life at all before that?
No, he didn't have kids. And I said from the very beginning that I didn't want to have more kids. And so he just kind of had to catch up and get his head around it. I said from the very start that I didn't want more kids because I thought, well, you should have the opportunity to go and have kids if you need to have kids. I didn't want to false advertise. So, but he said okay, and he just fell in love with mine gradually over time in a really organic, unforced way that. That they made happen, that he and my kids made happen. Of course, I facilitated it as much as I could, but I mainly let them find their way with it. It's quite a difficult thing to do, I suppose, or it could be a difficult thing to do. But I think he was extremely respectful of their boundaries. When we first started seeing each other, he didn't sleep in my house for ages and ages. So he would come to Brighton from London and stay in a hotel. Mm. And then I would put the kids to bed and then I'd go and see him and we'd have dinner and whatever. And I just didn't want somebody in my house unless I was absolutely sure they were going to stick around. I didn't want my kids to, you know, have a series of uncles that they met.
Yeah.
And he never, ever, ever pushed that. He completely, we were on the same page. He knew how important that was. I didn't have to convince him of that. And so it happened kind of slowly and it unraveled in a really nice way. And they absolutely adore him. And they also absolutely adore their father.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think actually that thing you said about letting them kind of find their place with it together and not kind of meddling too much, I think that's exactly the right thing to do, and incredibly instinctive if you know that on both sides there's good people, because then they will find their way to their relationship, which is what happened.
Yeah, and there was respect there, you know. He never tried to take the place of their father.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. He always really respected their relationship with their father, and it deserved respect, you know. My kids have a dad. Mm. And gradually he became their other dad without ever stepping on the toes of my ex. And similarly, my ex is getting married again, and she's lovely. His partner's lovely, and I think she's done the same thing. Really, everyone's fine.
No, that's well. I think that's really impressive. And you know, hearing you talk about that really reminds me of how my relationship with my stepdad evolved. Well, I was 7 when I met him, and he. The big thing I always say, if any of my girlfriends are in a position where they might become a stepmother, I'm always like, never, ever, ever slag off.
Oh my God, it's the most important thing.
It's the most important thing. Yeah, it will completely, you know, paralyze the relationship if you do that. So just, you have to, however hard it may be, you have to kind of remain very impartial and respectful.
Any divorce involving kids is really difficult. So even if you come from a place of mutual respect, it's still horrible. It's still one of the worst things you can go through. And there were definitely difficult times, and there were definitely times of conflict and times of high emotion and stress on both sides. However, whatever else happened, the one thing that neither of us ever, ever, ever did was speak ill of the other.
Mm, that's very impressive.
That's what your friends are for. Get your girlfriends round for a bottle of wine when the kids are out, and then go to town if that's what you need to do to feel better. But never, ever, ever speak badly of the other parent to the kids, because you're slagging off them. You're not criticizing your ex. You're criticizing 50% of their DNA, and it's horrible. I think it's abusive. And I have lots of grown-up friends who were really traumatized by their mother always slating their father, or their father always slating their mother. And I think it's a real act of cruelty, and I think you have to really, really make a concerted effort not to do it. I would never do it.
I think that's such a perceptive comment, though, to say it's actually... You're not slagging off the other person, you're slagging off, you know.
What are they supposed to do with that? She hates half of me. She hates the person who made me.
Yeah. Well,
It's horrible.
I think as well, if you're a child of, especially if you witnessed conflict between your parents when they were breaking up, you do sometimes feel a bit like, that means I am the joined, you know, embodiment of two people.
I'm the reason these people have to know each other.
Yeah, and also I'm now a physical embodiment of two people who didn't get on, which is quite a weird
concept. Isn't it?
Like, how am I supposed to live with myself if my parents couldn't make the marriage work? I mean, obviously, that's really oversimplistic. When you're tiny, I think you sometimes do kind of think about things that way because you spend a lot of your time working out, you know, I get this from my mum, I get that from my dad, I get this.
Yeah.
And it's quite hard to sometimes find the third thing, which is just the bit that's completely you. I think your kids will benefit massively from that.
They love him, they love his partner, they love my husband, they love me. Everyone is cool. You know, it doesn't happen overnight, but it did happen for us over a period of a few years. And, you know, it's comfortable. And she also, she has a daughter, she has a teenage daughter. They now have a baby together. And so everything's a bit elastic and messy in a kind of nice way. And everyone's happy and everyone gets on. So it's fine.
Yeah, that's kind of what family can be. I mean, it's a bit like with the godparent thing too. But you can make family really whatever works for you, I think.
Yeah.
It is an elastic term. I mean, it's like, I say this as someone who's got tattooed literally that says family on my arm. But I think you can kind of decide what family is to you.
Yeah, and also I really, really wanted my kids to understand that a relationship that ends is not a failed relationship. It's not a failure. I don't regret marrying my ex-husband. I don't regret choosing him as the father of my children. I don't regret that we have these kids together. I don't regret any of it. Just because our relationship wasn't meant to last forever does not make it a mistake or a failure. It just means it's a relationship that wasn't going to last forever. Mm-hmm. And I don't want them to view the end of things as a disaster or a failure.
Mm, well, that's a really lovely philosophy as well, actually. I think that obviously shows that you and your ex sort of handled things in a way that still gives a lot of credence to the relationship you had, actually, rather than kind of going, well, that didn't work out, so the whole thing's rubbish, you know. They can actually still extract the benefits.
Yeah, we had a great time. Yeah. We really loved each other. Absolutely, I wouldn't have changed that.
And do you have many memories of your bit as a single mum then? Because that's actually, in sort of fullness of time, that's not a massive amount of time to be on your own. It's not years and years as a... So does it, when you look back on it, does it feel like you can really remember when it's just the three of you?
Yeah. So I was on my own, I think it's probably about 18 months, maybe closer to 2 years.
I guess that is, yeah. It was, really, I mean,
it, yeah, it was hard. I felt guilty a lot. I mainly felt guilty about everything. I felt guilty that I was getting divorced. I felt guilty that I had to go to work. I felt guilty if I had to stay overnight somewhere for work. I sort of felt lonely and guilty, but I also wanted my kids to know that life goes on, and mum will always go to work, and mum will always make things happen, and mum will do what she needs to do to pay the bills and pay for all the stuff. And I didn't want things to change too dramatically for them when something huge was already changing. And so I tried to carry on. Also, you know, I was luckier than most in that I had some childcare. Of course, I didn't have any relatives the way other people do, but I did definitely have a little bit of help. And so we got through it. I said I would never, ever, ever marry again. And I'm sort of amazed that I did. I was adamant that I wouldn't.
But then you also thought you wouldn't be a mum sometime
exactly,
ago as well.
Exactly. And I am someone who kind of goes with the flow in life. I try not to plan too much. I have to plan my diary, but I don't like plan big events. I tend to just see how I feel about things, and you know if it's right.
And with the works, is it you've been writing about beauty from the start of...
No. So when I left school, which was really young, I moved to London and I was an assistant makeup artist because that was the only job I could get where I could get paid on an invoice from a petty cash box on a video shoot or something because I was too young to have a job.
So how old were you then, like 16 or something?
So I was 14 when I moved
14?
To London.
14? So you left school at 14?
I did leave school at 14. So I think... So I moved to London just before my 15th birthday, so maybe like a month or something for my 15th birthday.
Did you feel young at the time, or did you feel quite like, I'm just going to get on and do this?
I remember, in hindsight, I felt like I was totally on top of things and I couldn't wait to be an adult. I was one of those kids that couldn't wait to be an adult. Always wanted to work, always wanted to have a job and earn money and be free and independent. I always wanted that. I always wanted to leave where I grew up and move to London and all of that. But obviously, in hindsight, I now have a child the same age as I was, and it gives me horrors, like horrors. I cannot believe that nobody came to get me.
Yeah. That's kind of crossed my mind too.
And it's mad, isn't it?
Where were you living? Where did you move? Where did you have to come from?
I'm from South Wales, and I moved to London and moved in with my then boyfriend, who was an adult. All roads lead back to a bad man, don't they? But so I moved in with my boyfriend, who's an adult, and I lived with him in a housing association flat in Paddington. And his female flatmate, who's actually one of my children's godparents.
Ah, and, well, that's nice.
Yeah. and so I ended up finishing with him when I was 16, and she turned to him and said, "When are you moving out?" Because by then we were so close, and he left and I stayed. So, yeah, now having a 15-year-old, I'm absolutely appalled.
I'm so glad she was on the scene. She sounds like a good person.
Yeah, she's properly good.
Yeah.
And now, yeah, I look at my eldest and I'm like, you need me so much. And I must have really, really, really needed people. But then I did have a lot of support here. I made lots of friends very quickly. London was very different then to how it is now. I think if you were creative and curious and interested in people and accepting of people, you could kind of get involved in quite interesting things quite quickly. Mm. And I did. I just sort of met lots of gay men, and I met lots of drag queen gay men, and I met lots of record industry people, and I had no interest in being in the record industry, but they just happened to be the friends that I made. And they did look after me, you know.
Yeah.
Unbelievably, they did.
If you're the one who's always the young one in the social group, it's quite funny, isn't it, when you're not anymore? Because I was a bit like that when I was a teenager, always going out and about.
Yeah.
And then I remember when I suddenly was like, oh, I'm not the young friend that they have. There's other people coming in that are younger than me.
But yeah,
for a long time, I mean, if you were only like 14, 15 when you start, you were obviously like...
And they were all
our
my
friend,
mates.
Sally, she's only 16 or something.
All my mates were kind of like late 20s, early 30s maybe. And I was so, so, so young. And we would go clubbing together and stuff. But, you know, nothing that, you know, they were nice to me. It's not like the men tried to get off with me or, you know, I was really lucky. But mostly I did hang around with gay men, I have to say. So I was nicely looked after by lots of gay men.
Yeah.
And girls.
Yeah, well, they're kind of unchallenging for a teenage girl. It's a good choice, I think.
Yeah.
And, so I presume when you left, this was with your family. They were still in South Wales, and they weren't coming to London. And
Mm-mm.
So when you did start, you know, realize you were having, you know, decided you wanted a baby, you know, just because I think there probably are people that feel they haven't got. Did that throw up a lot of things about your childhood and your relationship with your mum, or did you already know that those things were complicated and that's why you'd left it behind so long before anyway?
It was definitely already complicated. We had very long periods of estrangement from the time I left home to the time she died. So we would have periods of 2 years here, 5 years there, 3 years there. And then the longest period was at the end, which was a 13-year period where we didn't speak until I found out she was terminally ill. And then we got back in touch. And so my whole life, I knew it wasn't right, and I knew that things were not normal, and that was not a relationship I wanted to have with my children. So that was very clear from the very beginning. I was adamant that my kids could rely on me. I was adamant that I would be there when they needed me. I was also very... I was obsessed with the idea that my kids should be able to tell me anything. That was the most important thing, that I wanted my kids to feel they could talk to me. And so whenever they talk to me about something, I try really hard not to judge what they're saying to me, because I don't want to close down the next conversation they feel like having with me. So I try to always listen and see it from their point of view, because I don't think that kids, especially teenagers, ever think, I'm not going to do that because my mum told me not to. They're going to do what they're going to do. So I want to be part of the conversation. I want to be part of the interaction. And so that stemmed from my own childhood, where I just didn't feel that I had that. So that was really, really important to me. I just wanted them. I always wanted them to know that the bills would be paid, that they would never come home to find a utility cut off, that there would always be food in the fridge, that I would turn up to the stuff. I would go to all the stuff. And I'm really lucky. You know, my job means that, although it's a crazy job with silly hours often and unpredictable hours, I can always do the thing. I can always go to the thing, because I will just work until 2 a.m. so I can go to the concert earlier on in the day. Whereas lots of women don't have that privilege because they have a boss breathing down their necks. And I haven't had that. I can always go to the swimming gala. I can always go to the Christmas concert, even if I have to do something really crazy with my diary to make it happen. I can always do it. And that was really important to me.
And has your job been flexible like that since you've had kids?
Yeah. So So my last staff job was at The Face magazine, which closed in 2004. And I had my first child in 2005. And I've been freelance that entire time. So I feel very lucky. You know, there are downsides to being freelance. You don't get sick pay, you don't get paid holidays. I always work on holidays, even though I say I'm not going to, and all of that. But that degree of flexibility of saying, I'm my boss, so I'm going to prioritise the things that I know are important, it's really invaluable.
And why do you think it's beauty that has sort of resonated with you so much that became...
So I went off on a tangent. So I moved to London. I became a makeup artist's assistant because that was the only thing that I really knew lots about that I could do, not legally, but I could do by the seat of my pants. But I always wanted to be a journalist. So I did that for a couple of years. Then soon as I was old enough to get work experience as a journalist, that's what I did, became a journalist. And I was a features writer, and then a features editor, and then an editor. And then when I had children, so I was features director at The Face, I had a child, and then I went back to work freelance, writing about all sorts of things, mainly cover interviews, celebrity things, and columns. And then as I got older, a thing happens when you're a female journalist. If you hang around long enough and you've had enough of a life and you've got a good enough reputation, you start being asked to write in the first person. And I only ever now really write in the first person. Mm. And then the beauty column, it was really weird. So I was a reader of the magazine, and the current editor, the then editor of Guardian Weekend, had employed a YouTuber to do this column. And I sort of feel a bit sorry for her, actually, because I don't think the Guardian or any broadsheets really took beauty seriously at all as a subject. And so they just kind of sent her a little bag of products, and then she had to write one or two sentences on the products. And, you know, she wasn't a writer. It was just all a bit kind of half-assed and by them, and then they gave it to her. And I was reading it one day back in the early days of Twitter, and as a beauty fan, I was really cross about it. And I said, this beauty coverage is terrible or whatever. And then the editor saw it and she called me in and she said, oh, well, actually, that YouTuber, we really want video content. And she won't make it because she wants to make it for herself for YouTube, which is completely fair enough. She wanted to own her own content. Mm-hmm. It was the early days. And they said, she won't do videos. We really need somebody who's going to do videos. So we're replacing her. It's between a few journalists. Can you go and write some sample columns? So I did. And then it was between me and another journalist who I latterly found out was writing a spoof beauty column. So they almost ran a spoof beauty column instead of a proper one. And me, and it could have gone to her or to me, but it went to me. And so, yeah, that was like 11 years ago, something like that. And I've been doing that ever since. And I had done some beauty for women's glossies before, but mainly not. Mainly my writing was interviews and columns.
I think with your work, like with, because you've set up the beauty banks, I think doing things like that really shows the proper value of how important it is to have time for yourself and to look after yourself and to feel good about yourself as part of your all-round mental health and self-esteem. I think, you know, it kind of emphasises how important it is and how a lot of people, if they don't have access to beauty products, they can go back to feeling that completely invisible feeling. It's just about how you can, another way you can nourish yourself, really. So when did you set up the beauty banks?
So we set it up just after I got married. So I got married in October 2017. I think we set up beauty banks at the very beginning of 2018. I was making a film for the BBC about homelessness. And I went to a homeless shelter in Cardiff where I was filming, and there was like a couple of cardboard boxes under reception at the homeless shelter, and it just had bits of toiletries in it, you know, like a tampon, a sanitary towel, a mini toothbrush or whatever. You know, the kind of things you get in a Premier Inn or whatever that you put into your suitcase, bits like that. And I spoke to the staff and they said that they just brought them in whenever they found some minis. They would just bring them in so that their clients could shave before a housing interview, or their female clients were taken care of when they had their period, or, you know, there was a bit of lipstick in there for if someone had a meeting with social services about her kids or whatever it was. And Joe, my partner in Beauty Banks, and I had been talking for a couple of months before about what we could do about the fact there's so much waste in the beauty industry. There's so many products that go unused. And we'd been wondering what we could do. And I sent Joe a picture of this cardboard box. And she said, that's it, that's it. We can get all the beauty companies to give us loads of beauty products and we'll distribute them to people who can't afford them, who really need them. Let's call it Beauty Banks. It was her idea to call it Beauty Banks. And I said, yeah, great. So we launched it like 48 hours later with a column, and it just went nuts. It went totally nuts.
So what was it like when it started? Where do you find these products? So you find them in homeless shelters?
So we get the products from beauty companies, and we distribute them to food banks around the country, homeless shelters, addiction centres, family centres, schools now, mental health trusts, you name it, wherever there are people who are experiencing poverty and are having to make horrible decisions like whether to eat or stay clean, we then supply those charities with shower gel, deodorant, toothbrushes, toothpaste, shampoo, conditioner, all those sorts of things. Basically, people often ask me what they should donate. Just think about yourself every morning. Think about everything that you use when you're in the shower cleaning your teeth. Just think about all the products you use, line them up. That's what we need, because everybody needs those things and they simply can't afford them.
And so if you want to help and get involved, where do you, what will you
send it to? So you can find us on our website. If you just Google Beauty Banks website, you'll come to the website, or you can contact me on Twitter. There are lots of ways you can help. You can set up a beauty bank in your shop or your office where people can drop in donations. You can drop them in Superdrugs around the country.
That's brilliant. It's really easy.
Yeah, it's really, really easy. There are loads and loads of ways you can help. And it's sort of turned into quite a big charity. We avoided registering as a charity for a really long time because both of us have about 8 jobs. And we were like, oh, we don't like want this huge charity. So we really avoided registering officially. We thought, oh, we don't need money. We can just distribute products. But actually, you do need money to distribute the products in the first place. But we were so naive. So eventually, under duress, we did register as a proper charity. And actually, we're now, you know, a medium-sized charity, people would probably say. And it's been a huge success. So we donate to around 180 charities around Britain, and then very many more schools, and at the beginning of the pandemic to key workers as well.
And so you sometimes meet the people that are the people who benefit from.
So we don't deal with end users so much. We deal with charities.
So we
supply to registered charities. So if, for argument's sake, you are a youth homelessness charity in Cardiff, we deal with them, and then they distribute to their clients. But we do get really lovely letters that they have given, that clients have given to the charities that are then passed on to us. Really like beautiful, touching letters. So we do still get to see the end of the line. We do still see the end of the process. But yeah, we're not at the coal face, because we're dealing with really big bulk donations.
Yeah.
And then we kind of, they trickle down.
No, but that's so impressive. That's brilliant. And actually, you're a perfect conduit for that, because you've already got those contacts and know those people. And
yeah.
And you can sort of say, come on. And you can also, if you wanted to, you could name and shame the brands that are rubbish at that, but also really celebrate the brands that yeah. actually get really...
Most people are good, and some of the brands... I mean, we are talking about huge volumes if it's a global multinational, but sometimes a small independent brand who gives you 500 bars of soap, that means the same to them as 10,000 deodorants yeah. from a multinational does. And it's really touching when people kind of really muck in. Really lovely.
And your boys, have they ever like got involved with the packaging?
Yes, so both of their schools collect for us.
That's great.
And my eldest son is on the charity committee at his school.
Oh, that's so good.
And they've definitely had buckets out. My friend Adam Kay is a writer, and he did a show in Brighton, and my boys had buckets going through the aisle. Very cynically, we sent the children with buckets because we thought people would give more money, which they did. There were loads of times in the early days when we were really small and my house was full of this product, and so was Joe's. Joe's got two little girls, roughly the same age as your two eldest, and then I've got my two boys, and very often in the early days they'd be sitting on the floor watching the telly separating Tampax from sanitary towels or separating moisturiser from face wash, and they would just kind of do it on autopilot. So it's good.
It's also good because when if people... have anything sort of glib to say about beauty, it's like, no, this is a real... I don't think people realise quite how much all of that counts into the same thing and how it feeds into how you feel. As you say, it's keeping yourself clean, making yourself presentable, having clean
hair.
I always
tell people that everybody, I think, can think of a time where the boiler's packed up or the hot water stopped for reasons that they didn't really understand, or they woke up too late to have a shower or whatever it is, and they're rushing around and they feel gross. And that horrible, gross feeling that you feel and you just think, oh, I'd do anything to just kind of get in the shower. There are lots of people who have to feel like that every single day because they don't have access to hot running water. They don't have access to products. They live in a chaotic household. They live in chaotic circumstances. They don't live anywhere at all. You know, there are lots of people... I just don't think that people should have to feel dirty. That just seems so Dickensian to me. The idea that you can't afford to be clean just seems really barbaric in a developed country at this time. It's just wrong.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I think everything that can be done, but I think the levels of poverty in the UK still is horrific.
Well, we're in a poverty crisis, officially, according to the UN. And just the idea of kids being shamed at school because they're... clothes that are dirty and they don't have access to water or toiletries. I hate that. I absolutely hate the idea of that. I can't bear it. And so we give teachers products to discreetly give to children in a private moment so that they have what they need.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's actually a really, I think you're right, that those kids, they must feel... I mean, actually, there's a girl on... have you watched any of that? It's really a silly program called Selling Sunset.
Yes, I've seen it all. Okay. I binged on it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
And the girl in it, she said that that's how she felt at school. Do you remember the girl?
Yeah.
Chrishell. In fact, actually, that I've thought of you with that before now because I saw recently you wrote about wearing flat shoes all the time now rather than heels. And it made me think of all those estate agents on Selling Sunset in their ridiculous stilettos, like wandering around building sites.
Sad and tired when I see them. They've got those massive platforms on, like platform Louboutins, haven't they? And I just think, oh, you're so slow on your feet because it's such an effort.
And sometimes they literally go to like a construction site and they've got a hard hat on one side and they're sort of stepping over with their wedges over like cobbles.
I mean, God, all power to them. I would lie in the road for a woman to look like however she wanted to look, but it just makes me feel old and tired. I'm over it, I think.
Me too. And actually, I think another thing, you know, with this year, I definitely felt like so much of that kind of feeling like you had to put on a certain face to be taken a certain way. I've really enjoyed the fact that that's relaxed.
I feel that I have been too comfortable for too long now to go back. It's like we're pushing a year almost. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, what are we in our eighth month or something?
Yeah.
And I just think I've now been too comfy for too long. I can't ever imagine doing that again.
No, and I think now that we've sort of let that... Sometimes I feel a bit like this year with all the different roles we play and the normal sort of the norms of social interaction, so much of it has gone, but like now we know that, you know, it's a bit when I went into the bank during the midst of lockdown and the guy was speaking to me, we just ended up chatting about how he was finding working in the bank and having his kids at home all the time and all this stuff. And it's just like all those sort of roles we play about how we normally interact. It's like we can actually talk to each other in a totally different way now because we've all experienced something together that whoever you are, your life has been altered.
Yeah.
It's quite astonishing.
It's going to be very hard, I think, for people to justify why mums have to be in the office 5 days a week, why people have to go to stupid meetings in stupid places, why people have to spend so much money on petrol and on motorways going to work. I think there's going to be a lot of stuff where people are going to have to accept that life has shifted.
Mm. Yeah, I know. It's well, it has. It just has. And it won't. It took me a long time to understand what it meant when people said it's not going to go back to how it was before. Because it doesn't mean that things won't come back that you're familiar, but everything will just have a slightly different emphasis, probably.
Were things mental in your house during lockdown?
The first
couple of weeks.
It's a
lot of children to be locked inside.
Honestly, when it first started happening, I just thought, I've been a complete mug. I've had too many children. And I went from feeling very clever about having, you know, it's five people and they're all from 1 to 16 thinking, I'm such a moron. I can't actually do this. I can't do it where they're all just here and we're all in the same room all the time. But we kind of found our way through it. I mean, there were some, I think probably, I felt like what's happening here was happening in loads of family households. And so sometimes things were quite nice, actually, you know. We can have, we've all had Sundays here together or bank holiday Mondays where you feel like we're normally at school or work, but hey, we're all here together.
Yeah.
But, yeah, sometimes we just find ourselves having these outbursts of anxiety and shouty things where you're just like, because there's a tension and, you know, Richard and I are constantly like trying to work out like, what does this really, oh, look, all our work's been cancelled. Okay, that's that. What about next year? Well, who knows? And, you know, just the realisation of like, okay, everything I thought I was going to be doing this year is gone.
Yeah, no, same.
I felt totally paralysed. I felt very uncreative. I felt like there's nothing I could do. I felt like, ah, why didn't I learn to play piano better or play guitar better so at least I can accompany myself and write something. No, I can't do that. I don't know how anything works in Richard's studios. I can't record a song. Just felt like, I really should have got some more skills going here.
I know. I'm obsessed with learning to sew at the moment. I really want to learn to sew. It's been one of those
periods. On the machine?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been one of those periods, hasn't it, where you're like, what is massively lacking in my skill set?
How are you getting on with the sewing?
No, so I haven't started yet, but it's my focus. I've just decided that that's my project for next year. I'm going to learn to sew because I cannot sew.
Because I wanted to sew and I got a sewing machine, but then I got stuck on how to wind a bobbin.
So, right, yeah, yeah.
So that was like, this is actually something that happens quite early on in the sewing. So
yeah.
It's the end of that.
Yeah, I remember
it's in the attic
not
if you
being
want
able
it.
To do that.
You could take it home with you. You can start
and
now.
Just really get my
when
hair
you've learned
blinded.
To wind the bobbin, come back and tell me. I'd love to be able to make my own clothes.
I'd just love to be able to, like, hem some jeans or something.
My own alterations. That would be incredible.
Yeah.
Because I buy a lot of secondhand stuff and then I've got a big pile of things. Like, oh, yeah, I just need to make that shorter, make that
and you just don't get around to it for, like, a year.
Oh, a year would be good for me. I've had some things probably from, like, before I moved house, I think.
Yeah,
like, over a decade.
No, I'm the same. I buy loads of secondhand stuff and I do tell myself, oh, well, that just needs shortening. That just needs taking in
exactly.
a bit.
Yeah. I know. One day. Well, yeah, I'd say teach me when you've learned the bobbin bit. But yeah, no, lockdown was a very strange time. And I look back on it and I feel sometimes I'll see something that was very much part of that time and it makes me feel kind of odd. It's just, I think it's just that hum of anxiety alongside sort of preoccupying yourself. You know, and some of it was quite, I'm not someone that likes, I don't get FOMO or anything like that. So I quite liked.
Yeah.
I didn't miss like pubs or any of that
no,
sort
I
of
love
thing.
Being at home.
Yeah, I like that too. And I like being around for bedtime every night. And my work takes me away a lot, like you were saying, you know, about feeling guilty when you go away for work. Like that's something that I've had to deal with a lot. And I was about to be away a lot this year and I thought I'd be away for 2 birthdays in April. So I was glad I was here for that. Although I have to say, Ray had, I think what's probably one of the saddest lockdown birthdays. It was his 8th birthday and he literally lined up all his teddy bears and toys, soft toys in the garden and did a sort of birthday picnic with his toys, which is equal parts sweet and really...
Pathos. Yeah. That is really...
We sort of had to take pictures and things. There's a Polaroid in the kitchen somewhere. It just looks very... It looks sort of very fit, like 1950s sad.
Yeah, yeah.
Poor Christopher Robin.
Yeah. Oh, bless. No, we had... a birthday in lockdown as well.
Yeah, we had 4 in April actually. Sunny had what he called his super sweet quarantine 16 because it was just like, happy birthday, you're 16, you can't go anywhere.
Yeah.
To be fair, my dad would have loved it if that had been me. He was like, I think a lockdown around my teenage years would have suited my dad really, really well.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, I think it's been really hard for the teenagers because they're just all about the friends, aren't they?
Exactly.
And when you were finally allowed to have people in your garden, the first thing we did was say to my eldest, you know, do you want to have Isaac round? You know,
yeah.
And he needed it. I think teens really need it, need their mates.
Well, actually, for Sonny, weirdly, he kind of copes with it quite well because he likes just being in his bedroom and listening to music, and a lot of his friends are online. So actually for him...
Yeah, they talk all day, don't they?
Yeah, he was actually kind of all right. I think it was my younger one, like Ray, I think, really found it the hardest at 8 because he's so into his social life at school, and then he couldn't self-perpetuate any of the social things. So he couldn't say, I'm just going to message my friends or whatever. So it would all be down to me to organise, and I think he just felt a bit lost without it. Whereas the little two were fine, and Kit was fine too. We're just, making little videos on YouTube and stuff like that, and started writing films and things. It kind of kept him quite busy, really. But I think I found it hardest maybe with my headspace. I just felt like I had nowhere to run off and hide. But that's okay. We got through it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we did. And, and people endured so much that we didn't have to. And it's just a weird time, isn't it? I think everyone's just allowed to find it weird without having to compare their experiences to others. It's just bloody weird, isn't it?
Bloody weird, yeah. And even now, sometimes I think, is this really happening?
I know.
Yeah, I sort of imagine I've just been like quantum leaped into now, and I look around, like everybody's in face masks, like I'm trying to work out what's happening. What a crazy world.
It's getting to the point where we've kind of been in it for so long that I'm slightly losing a grip on how it was before, yes. Which I find quite surreal.
Well, it's like when you watch TV and you think like an old film and they're like, they hug each other hello or something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
There's more than 50 people at that party. What are they doing?
Yeah.
That wedding's huge.
Yeah, it's so weird to think that I've kind of lost a year of my life, or in my kids' case, it's sort of almost 10% of one of their lives has been spent with coronavirus, which is really bizarre considering we'd never even heard of it a year ago.
I know, and like things that happened back in February. I remember doing like a DJ gig in February, and now I'm like, why were we all out? Did we not think anything was about to happen?
I know. I had a breast reduction in February, and it was like such a big thing for me to do. And I did it in February, and I was looking at my diary in the run-up to it thinking, okay, so I've blocked these 2 weeks out to recover, and then I've got to do this, then I've got to go and do this event here. And I was kind of all over the country. But in fact, as soon as I had the operation, pretty much within a couple of weeks, we were locking down, and so I did I was just at home recovering the whole time, and it was just really strange, like my body had really changed and I was just in the house. It just seemed like a very strange time all around.
And how
really
do you feel weird. Now do you feel like
great it's the best decision I've ever made.
Wow, that's very cool. There's no, and it's all fully, you feel all
has been fully healed for ages. So I had it done on February the 18th. It was the night of the Brit Awards, and my husband came to my hospital room and we watched the Brit Awards in bed, and I cannot remember a single thing about the Brit Awards. I was so high. I woke up and I was just so high and so happy that I'd had the operation, but also like smacked out of my head on drugs from the doctor, that I can't remember anything about the Brit Awards other than my husband brought me an honest veggie burger, which I love. And I sat there just sort of giggling in bed watching the Brits.
I don't think you'd be the first person to watch the Brits.
No, exactly.
I'm not able to remember anything.
Exactly.
It's like you were there.
It was very much on brand. Exactly.
Oh, well, it's like, I mean, one other question I always quite like to ask about motherhood, and if you feel like it's influenced your work and your creativity. But is it, for you, is the beauty thing your own thing? Do you feel like when you do that, you're quite selfish about it? Or does it feel like an extension of when you're a mum and needing to feel like you again?
That's a really interesting question. I think, so despite anything else about my mother, my maternal grandmother and my mother always looked nice. They did always look nice. My mum was really beautiful. And the two of them were always pulled together. And no matter how little money there was, there was always lipstick on and hair done and so on. And so I suppose I associate it with just getting on with life. And that is something that I have always done. So they were influential to me in that way. My kids are really kind of, bemused by it. They'll ask me for a serum sometimes because they're teenagers. They're obviously concerned about their skin. So they'll say, Mum, can I test a serum for you or whatever? So they're a little bit involved. I suppose mainly it's for me. There are no girls in the house to really, really love what I do. But I don't care. I love having boys. I love having boys. And of course, if I had two girls, I'd be sitting here saying I love having girls. But I really love having boys. I feel very comfortable having boys. I grew up with only boys in the house. My mother left when I was a baby, or a toddler rather. So there was just me, my dad, and my two brothers for a really long time. And so I feel very comfortable in a male household. It just kind of feels... it feels right. So I don't really need them to be interested in my pursuits. And we share loads. So my main passion in life is film. My eldest son shares it with me. So we have just like our thing together. We watch loads of films, just the two of us. And we all love music. And my eldest son in particular is obsessed with fashion. And I really love clothes. So we talk about fashion a lot and films a lot. So actually we have really sort of deep connections in terms of our interests that I don't really need them to care about my work. What I do want, though, is I always wanted them to know that all of the things you have come from mum working hard, and that is a reality of life. I hate entitlement. I can't stand entitlement. And the thought of having entitled children would really, really, really bother me. And so I've always wanted them to know that if you lose a jumper at school, I have to work harder in order to replace the jumper you lost. And so I want them engaged in my work insofar as I need them to understand it's important, and consequently that whatever they do for a living will be important. Mm. And I don't care what they do, but I want them to be serious about what they do.
Yeah, no, I agree with so much of what you just said. And I think you're right, that entitled thing is just something that I can't...
Awful.
You get it in a lot of grown-ups as well, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
People where they're just expectant about what's supposed to happen next. And actually, I think, especially if you work in creative jobs, you're sometimes... Well, actually, you know what? It probably happens across the board, but I just think from the get-go in creative, you're very encouraged to be quite competitive with your peers. And, you know, you feel like you're, especially with women, actually, they pit women up against
each
other. Yeah,
of course, there's
the
only room for one.
Yeah, which is so tedious. And then from that, you're encouraged to sort of really feel quite annoyed about opportunities that weren't open to you. Whereas actually, I'm always a bit like, who's to say I'm even supposed to be still singing for now? Like, it's not a given. Nothing you've done in the past is a given that you're going to be able to keep going.
Absolutely.
So you've really got to keep, like, don't complain and just get on and do the work.
Yeah, and kind of understand that people, part of being alive is doing loads of things you don't want to do.
Yes.
And so my sons, sometimes there are things they really don't want to do, and my sympathy is limited because I'm like, do you know what? I have seen two people this week that I had to see that I didn't really want to see. I've done this, 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 and this that I didn't want to do. That's life, and actually the majority of my life I do like and I do want to do, and that is just how the checks and balances work.
Yeah.
So you do need to play rugby because at the moment that is your job. That is the thing you have to do. And I want them to understand that it's not all lovely, you know, and part of being a responsible person is to sometimes grit your teeth and be with people you don't really want to be with and do the stuff that doesn't really excite or interest you. And that's important.
Yeah, it is.
People are relying on you to do a thing.
I know, so there's certain responsibilities that come with the business of being you and getting on with the things you've got to do. And
I find that an empowering part of motherhood, though. I find when they were little, I did the thing that I think kind of all parents do with real love and heart, which is my kids would say, oh, I don't like it, I can't do it, whatever. And I'd say, of course you can do it, of course you can do it. You can do anything, of course you can, you're brilliant. You can. And you do that thing with little children. But actually the greatest thing, one of the greatest things about having teenagers is that moment where you go, do you know what? Yes, you are not very good at rugby. You're too short for it. Actually, you're not built for it. You're much better at other things. I can absolutely see why that's a ball ache for you. Totally. However, you still have to do it. Just keep your head down, get through the lesson, criticise your teacher all you want when you're at home, but you be polite and you be well behaved. And I think it's just been really nice to just hear my kids and not go, no, no, and overrule them and tell them everything will be fine. It's actually been really lovely and interesting to hear what my kids are telling me and go, yeah, you're right. He does sound like a dick.
You know,
he does sound awful. Not, I'm sure he doesn't not like you, darling, the way I used to do. Now I'm like, yeah, that teacher doesn't sound very nice.
No, you're right. That's a really good thing to, trap not to fall into. And the other thing that I do, which I really am trying to stop, is trying to fix things for them, the things they don't like, the things they don't want to do, and go, okay, I'll write an email to that and see if I can get you out of that, and I'll try and change that for you. And then I'm like, Like, actually, you know, so proud. My my second eldest has got his first school detention today.
Yeah.
And he was like, "Mummy, can you just tell them I can't do it and all this?" And I said, "You know what, Kate? You just kind of got to suck it up." Really.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that's life.
Yeah. And it's like, it's not going to be that hard. And he's like, "But I didn't do this, that, and the other." And I'm like, "Yeah, but there's obviously things they feel like rules, school rules."
Yeah.
And they're trying to teach you that this is a deterrent. Yeah. So just do it.
And also, nobody ever died from an extra hour at school. Do you know? Like, just do it. And I find that a really refreshing part of having older kids, of just going, yeah, that's life. Yeah. I hear you. It is rubbish. I can see why you're pissed off. I totally get it. However, part of life is getting on and doing it. And that's so much better than going, it'll be fine. It'll be fine, the way I used to do when they were little.
I've got to still stop doing that. I still tend to try.
Well, you have little
things.
Ones than me, so it's slightly different.
Yeah, but I think also sometimes it's like, I'm not very good at seeing them doing things where they feel uncomfortable or sad about something. So I tend to be a bit like, what can I do to make that easier? But actually, sometimes I just got to get through it.
Yeah.
But I think...
And it's empowering for them to know they can fix things themselves and make themselves feel better, I think.
No, that's very true. And also, as you say, they get through it and it's not actually that bad.
It's never that bad.
Nah. I think there's so many things you've said that are really, I've just been nodding along and I really agree with. And I think, I just feel like, I keep thinking, it's so impressive that you went from feeling like you didn't really want to have kids and you didn't really have maybe an example in your life of that's the kind of mother that I wanted to be. But you've managed to kind of get through to actually having this very balanced and grounded approach to raising your boys. And I mean, what do you think you back in your 20s would have thought of you as a mum if you met you now?
I think I would say I'm a good mum because my kids are really nice. They are really nice and they're not messed up. And I think that in years to come, if they end up in therapy, which is always a chance for everybody, we've all got stuff we want to iron out. But if they ended up sitting on a therapist's couch, I think it would be wear and tear they would be talking about. They would not be talking about anything major. And so I'm very pleased about that. I'm very impressed with them. I think they're really good dudes and they're good friends and they're good brothers to one another and they're really good sons. And so, yeah, I think I must have done all right. I think all of us, you know, I think that their father, their stepfather, their stepmother and me, I think, you know. But yeah, I'm the constant in all of it. And I'm really grateful that it turned out okay.
Yeah, me too. That's lovely. I'm impressed with that and also very impressed with the very grown-up way you have your tea. Because when you said you hardly have any milk, that is...
I know, it's nearly black, isn't it?
It's actually, have you tried just not having any milk?
Yes, I don't quite like it. But I've always
just need to know it's there.
Somebody was saying recently that in all my tutorial videos and review videos and stuff, I always look like I'm a heavy smoker because my tongue is stained. It's because I've always got a cup of tea on and I don't have milk in it.
So. Yeah, mine's like baby tea in comparison. Like 1.5 sugars of milk, but that's like proper grown-up.
I know, it's really evil, isn't it?
I'll never be that grown-up. Well, thank you. So that was Sally and I having a chat about raising our boys and about extended families. And like I said, there was a lot of stuff that really resonated with me. I think some of it my parents got really right with raising me as part of a divorced, you know, separated family. And some of it maybe was a bit trickier. I mean, golly, I don't have first-hand experience of what it's like to be a parent on that side of things, just to be the kid. But I would say that I thought what Sally said about never, ever, ever... slagging off the other half because to the child that's half of them, that really stayed with me. And I think I will be passing that on to any of my friends that are going through similar situations. You know, you're right, that is true. It is half of that kid. It feels like half of you. And you spend a lot of your childhood, don't you, working out what you get from your mum, what you get from your dad, what's just you. And actually, now that I'm raising small people, I can see that they're mainly just them, raised sitting very quietly by my side. Do you have any thoughts on anything I'm saying, Ray? Any thoughts at all? Okay, just shaking his head. You just want my phone. What do you want to play with my phone when you get it? If you don't tell me, I'm not going to give it to you. What are you going to play with it when you get it?
TikTok.
Are you going to do some dances?
No.
No? Just watch stuff. Watch funny stuff. Okay. Can I watch it with you?
Fine. Thank you. Why are you whispering?
I don't like it when people whisper on audio. Anyway, look, I'm nearly finished. Do you want to say bye-bye and thank you for listening?
Bye-bye and thank you for listening.
So with all the enthusiasm a boy waiting to play on his mum's phone can muster. If you haven't put your decorations up, have a good week with it. If you fancy listening to Christmas songs, come and join us at the Kitchen Disco in a week and a half. In the meantime, stay safe, stay sane, stay festive. We're nearly there, nearly the end of 2020. We did it, folks. Anyway, rambling as ever. Lots of love. Race is nearly done. My tea's been drunk and my phone's about to go into the hands of my 8-year-old. Lots of love. See you soon. Oh, next week, before I go, just going to tell you, next week I've got a really good one. An artist friend of mine called Kerry Reichardt lives down the road. Her house is remarkable because it is covered, and I do mean literally covered, every aspect of it in tiny mosaic tiles. So it must be, I don't know, million tiles? I don't know how many tiles it takes to cover a house front and back. It's a literal work of art. It's beautiful. I spotted the house long before I knew Carrie, and I was really struck by it. But her story is a fascinating one. You're going to absolutely love it. So please do join me for that next week. And in the meantime, lots of love and festive cheer.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.